Since 1994, Will Hornyak has been weaving tales of mythic proportion, from his award-winning environmental wise words regarding watershed wellness to Irish stories of legend and lore. We are fortunate to have him here with us today to discuss his craft. Welcome, Will.
Thank you. It's really nice to be here with you.
Well, we're glad to have you. My questions here, I have your tales are as diverse and universal as the crowds you address. Can you speak to the influence of travel and the creation of your folktale programs?
I actually spent about a year and a half living in South America. I went down there as a newspaper reporter, and that influenced me a lot because I had to learn a different language. So I started to listen to the sound of words a lot more than I had to before. And I did a lot of hiking, a lot of going to little villages. And it was then I started to read poetry for the first time. And on these long walks, I would recite poetry. And I started to become more interested in, you know, theater, poetry, the sound of words, than just the meaning of words, which as a journalist is a lot of what language is about, you know. So I started to collect stories when I got back, and I have friends that are teachers and librarians, and I started volunteering my time just telling stories to little kids at first because I was terrified to tell stories to adults. And one thing sort of led to the next.
Although kids will keep you terribly honest, won't they?
That if you want the toughest ones, you get a room full of 10-year-old boys, and they will tell you exactly how they feel. And plus, you know, if they're bored, they're going to show you. They're not going to be polite. You know?
Well, in your work with kids, seniors, and prisoners, I understand, is there one more receptive group than another? Or,
well, you know, they're all receptive in different ways, I think. I work with this group called Open Hearts, Open Minds, and they're Portland-based nonprofit, and they bring theater, dialogue, and storytelling into the prisons. And the guys that are interested in coming around to do something with theater or storytelling have usually already done a lot of personal work in their lives in prison, and they are tremendous individuals, and give them a little bit of opportunity with language and story and poetry, and they just take off, you know.
That's got to be wonderful to watch.
I'm humbled again and again and again just by showing up because they've got so much life experience, you know, in difficulties as well as in, you know, beautiful aspects of life too, but they've been through it. And those that can articulate something from those places, their stories bring a lot of grace and a lot of healing and a hell of a lot of humor too.
Right.
So.
And I would think the drama would kind of resonate.
Yeah. You know, one thing that story does, and drama too, is that it helps them to be a little bit larger than life. And they need that sometimes because, you know, in prison, they're learning how to like rein it in and how to be a good person and all this kind of stuff. And theater lets them explore different aspects of character. So I've been watching the Shakespeare in the prison. My friend Johnny Stallings and several of his people do that at Two Rivers Prison. And I'm just floored every time I go to a performance because it's so honest. It's got so much dynamism and energy to it, you know.
Oh, that's wonderful. So. And I understand, too, that you've kind of bridged that communication. It works with all groups. You've done a lot of workshopping with communications in the corporate world.
Yeah, yeah. I started teaching a class at Merrillhurst called Storytelling and Professional Communication. And so people took it. They were communications majors and some business people. And after a while, they started hiring me to come to their organizations to help them tell the stories that reflected their values and vision. Because a lot of times, you know, companies will have these great sounding public relations brochures, but it doesn't really tell the story. It kind of gives you the end of the story. So I try to ask them, you know, what's the hell that you went through to create the paradise, you know, that you want to have us believe in about you and your company? Show us the stories that you went through to become who you are. And that becomes in some ways, I think, an honest way of not just having these big fat words like, you know, we're generous or we're creative or we have a lot of integrity, but show us, you know, what that actually means. Tell us a story.
People want to hear about how it blossomed from someone's garage.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That's true. Sure. Sure.
You have spoken of the great unity and healing among disparate groups. How have you witnessed that kind of making that happen?
Yeah. Well, one of my influences is a great storyteller and a mythologist named Michael Mead. He's from the New York area originally, but he lives on Vashon Island now. And for years and years, he's used storytelling, poetry, and mythology to work with at-risk youth, Vietnam vets, all types of returning vets, and incarcerated populations. And every year he does a men's meeting, a men's gathering in Mendocino, California. About 100 people come. And it's very diverse in terms of, you know, you have guys that have been in gangs from East L.A. You have guys from Watts. You have, you know, people from the Northwest. You have all ages represented. And the fur really flies. But one of the things that Michael does is that he sort of grounds it in a story. He tells one myth over a five-day period. And each day he tells a different part of it. And people comment about how that's like their life. And it's interesting because one myth can draw out totally different meanings from people. But you get a chance to see what everybody, how people respond differently to the same story, you know?
Wow.
And so I've really seen, you know, myth and poetry, and he also does dance and things to draw out the essence and the wisdom and the humor and also the pain that's in a room, too.
Does that ever cease to fascinate you, how people create their own hooks into what their takeaway is from something?
That's one of the reasons I stay in doing this, because I'm endlessly fascinated by how people respond to a story. Like, one time in Mendocino, there was a story told of the Firebird, great Russian story. And at a certain point in the story, a hunter comes upon a beautiful golden feather in the middle of a forest. It's about 3 feet long. It's on fire. It fell from the breast of the Firebird. And he's never seen anything so beautiful in all of his life. And just as he bends down to pick it up, his horse says, "If you pick up the feather, you'll know the meaning of trouble." And the hunter backs away. And then he thinks, if I don't pick up the feather, I'll know the meaning of regret. He doesn't know what to do. And Michael Mead will stop the story right there and ask the room, "What has that feather been for you? Something that was so beautiful that you wanted to pick up, but a part of you said, if you do that, you're going to die."
Ooh.
Ever feel that? And some guys will say, you know, that fiery feather, that was an M16 when I fought in Vietnam. That was firepower. Somebody else will say, that was a line of cocaine. Light as a feather, burn my whole house down. Somebody else will say, that was the first time I fell in love. I felt like I could fly. I felt like I was on fire. And everybody has a different reply. And as a result, the story becomes more interesting. It has more meaning. And also, all of a sudden, you start to think, I never thought of it that way. But that's an interesting way to see it. And so there's just more intelligence in the room. It's almost like the myth draws the intelligence of the room out.
Does that kind of alter at all how you know, in the years that you've been doing it, do you kind of create a different versions as a result of kind of the feedback or input you get from audiences? Or
mm-hmm. Yeah. One way I think of a story is that it's always a collaboration between the teller and the audience. And so I never memorize the story line by line. I sort of remember the images and the places in the story. So I feel like the story needs to be different, has to be different between teller and audience each time it's rendered, you know. There are certain lines I will repeat, you know, again and again that I've almost memorized. But with a story, you really want to, it's not a play. You're not doing the same thing exactly the same. And
I've done a little theater. Oh, it's not always the same either.
Okay. I hear you. But what you're saying is really, it's really true. It's like I learn a lot about the story by telling it to an audience. I can only work on it so much myself. And then by telling it, you know, part of what will happen is you'll tell it and I'll think, man, that was a really brilliant line and nobody laughed at it whatsoever. You know, I think I'll pull that out of there, you know. And I always try to have a 2 and a 10 and a 20-minute version of a story because sometimes a story will work for a very short period of time. Sometimes you'll have more time and you can stretch the story out. So I sometimes say a good storyteller is like a good chef. You know, you can give a chef chicken and she can make chicken cordon bleu or she can fry something up in 5 minutes, you know. And I think as a storyteller, I feel that I need to be adaptable to the moment, you know.
You've got 50 different chicken recipes in your pocket.
Exactly. You know, one of my friends, he's a great storyteller. You have one of his CDs here in the studio. Kevin Kling is his name. Brilliant, brilliant man, and really funny. And he once said something that I agree with. He said a storyteller should be as useful to his community as a plumber. And I thought, that resonates with me, you know, to know lots of different stories and to be able to adapt them for different occasions. And then sometimes somebody will call me up and say, hey, we're doing a unit in my sixth grade class on Australia. Can you find some Australian stories? And I'll say, okay, and find something like that.
I need a story with a lot of bruises in it.
Exactly.
Well, and that makes me curious as to, I know you have extreme like repertoire in Irish lore. Uh-huh. Is there, do you, and it sounded like when we were talking earlier that was a big influence on your path into storytelling was Irish storyteller that kind of captivated you.
Yeah, that's true. There was I guess I was about 30 years old and I heard Jay O'Callaghan, brilliant storyteller from the Boston area. And he was up at the Museum of Science and Industry in Seattle doing a show for a family show. And there was about 300 people in the audience and he performed for an hour. It was just him on stage in a spotlight. And I'd never seen a storyteller before. And suddenly the lights went up and I literally asked myself, where did everything go? Because I had made all these characters, I'd created all these settings, I had all these emotions, and I realized, oh, that was just him and our imaginations. And it was beautiful because at that moment I felt like we had done something together, the storyteller and the audience. And that's one thing that's always attracted me to storytelling, is it always feels like it's a co-creation, you know, because it's a lot of work. The audience is making all the images in their imagination, you know. So.
Wow. And when you were living in South America, mm-hmm. were you spoke of hiking mm-hmm. Among small villages?
Yeah.
And were you able to collect a lot of the sort of village tales and lore along the way kind of thing?
It wasn't so much that. I just started trekking a lot in the Andes because I just like to walk from place to place with a backpack. And I would stop and I would have conversations with people. So it wasn't so much that I was getting their stories as much as I was just getting kind of a feel for the place. And I would ask them about the history of their village and, you know, what they knew. I would ask them simple questions about the farming and the weather. And part of it was just getting into a feel of their conversation, the rhythm of their language and traveling from place to place. And then I had a book of the Norton Anthology of English Literature with me. You know, I have a backpack and like an 8-pound book in there. And I would take it, I would read poems every night, read them aloud in my tent. And then I would write poems down and I started reciting them just aloud. And then one night I was walking around the ruins outside of Cusco and I started to remember all these snippets of poetry that I've been writing down and you know, talking for months. And it came out almost like a play. And I sat down in the plaza of Cusco and I wrote my first little one-act play. Just basically, it was just stringing all these different poems. You know, Yeats and Neruda and Whitman and all this stuff. And it made no sense whatsoever, but I thought it was brilliant, you know.
Stream of consciousness poetry. It sounds awesome.
It was great. It was great. But anyway, it was inspiring to me. And I just said, a part of me said, this is what I want to do. I had no idea what that was. But, you know, I want to work with spoken word and I want to work writing and with performance. So when I saw Jay, so much came together for me. It's like, oh, you could do that as a storyteller. I get it, you know. This is a poem I'll do tomorrow night. There's a show that I have now called Waking Finn McCool. And Finn McCool was an Irish poet warrior. And I start the show off this way. I am hawk on a cliff. I am a stag of 7 tines. I am boar for valor. I am salmon in a pool. I am the clash of weapons. I am the point of spears. I am a hill of poetry. I am a word of skill. I am fire of thought in the mind of man. I am the dew on the grass, tears of heaven. I am lake on a plain. I am the sound of woman's voice wooing man to pillow. I am the enchantment of wind. Who but I knows where the sun goes to rest? Who but I knows the ages of the moon? And who but I spreads light upon the gathering hills? And that's a poem reputed to be created by one of the earliest of the Irish poets, whose name was Amargan, an ancient Irish poet.
And is this how you came to know Finn McCool?
I came to know Finn through several sources. One was a book called Irish Fairy Tales by James Stephens. James Stephens was a contemporary of James Joyce. And I fell in love with the stories that he told of Finn. In particular, the boyhood of Finn. Finn is basically born an outlaw. His father was the leader of this famous band of poet warriors, and his father was murdered. And when Finn was born, the rival chieftain found out that he'd been born, and he came for him. So he had to be spirited away and raised in the wilds, all alone, raised by two aunts, one who was a druidess and the other one who was a warrior and teacher of warriors, because there's an ancient tradition of Irish women warriors. And if you know any Irish women, you know that's not much of a stretch. So I fell in love with the Finn story, and I've been working on it I told it about 6 years ago, and I've continued to work on it. And that's what I'm doing now, and that's where that poem comes from.
Initially, the idea of poet warrior sounds kind of contradictory.
Yeah.
But then if you think way back to in a kind of a folkloric context, mm-hmm. I would guess the better the warrior, the better he or she was to recount the tales.
Yeah, that was
the war.
I think that was a big part of it. In the context of Finn McCool, the idea was that there was nothing more intoxicating than battle, warfare, and bloodshed. And they believed that if a man also didn't have poems in his heart, wise stories in his brain, and rhythm in his bones, that he could easily become more intoxicated by battlefield than hearth fire, could come to love his own battle cry more than the sound of his own woman's voice, you know? And so because of that, the Fianna demanded that the men know tomes of poetry, be able to create poetry, and that they knew all the old stories. And they had they lived by the old code, which was never give a sword to a man who can't dance, right?
I would love for you to tell me more about that. I know you have that on your website, willhorniak.net.
Right. Thank you. Yeah, it's a really old idea, is that if a warrior's heart is not tempered, you know, the warriors are intense. They're incredibly courageous. They're filled with fire. And that has to be balanced out with water. That has to be balanced out with creativity. It has to be balanced out with openness and imagination. Otherwise, it's too easy to become a savage instead of a warrior. And that's what the Fianna were all about, is making sure that a man knew how to stop a battle as well as to start one, right? And so it was in a very small band of a much larger army, but they were noteworthy also because the Fianna lived out of doors most of their lives.
I'm not familiar with that idea or the people, the Fianna.
Yeah, Finn McCool was the leader of a band of warriors, and their name was the Fianna. And the Fianna was a small part of a much larger army of the king. But the Fianna were noteworthy because they lived by the old code, never give a sword to a man who can't dance, and they knew all these poems. But they also lived outdoors most of the time. They patrolled the Irish coasts and protected it from raids.
The Irish Coast Guard.
Yeah, exactly. But they traveled on foot, and they lived by hunting, fishing, and gathering. So they said that the Fianna, they served the High King, but they lived closest to the heart of Erin, the goddess Ireland, because Erin was the body of the goddess, which we call Ireland. The land was her body, the rivers her blood, and the air her breath. And the Fianna knew every part of Ireland, you know, every glen and wide fen and plain and mountaintop. And so they would say that the Fianna lived closest to the heart of Erin. So on one hand, there's this intense warrior culture. On the other hand, they're totally devoted to the goddess Erin. And to me, that's in part the combination of the, you know, poet warrior or lover warrior together, where both developments are very strong.
I'm here today talking with Will Horniak, a very accomplished storyteller. We had been talking about how travel really kind of colors the storytelling, like, development or creation.
I haven't traveled all that much. I've been to Europe, and I lived in South America 3 separate times. So I know Argentina and Bolivia and Peru, a little bit of Venezuela and Chile. But to me, one of the most important parts of travel is, for one, being in a place where a different language is spoken, or even if it's English, if it's spoken in a different way. Like going to Ireland, you hear that's a whole other form of English, you know. And then hearing Gaelic, and there's this feeling, you know, because I'm Irish and also Hungarian, there's a feeling when I hear Gaelic that I should know this language. I can feel it in my bones somehow. There's some familiarity with it, you know. And so that's part of it, is just the way people converse and talk. And in part, to me, storytelling is a celebration of the different ways that people talk. You know, the colloquialisms and local flavor and color. I went to Texas one time in Dallas, and I got off the plane into the cab, and the guy says, "Where are you from?" I say, "Oregon." He goes, "Man, there's some great fishing out there, isn't there?" And immediately, we're just into telling fishing stories, you know. But I find some places, especially places that are more out in the country, are like, you know, coming to Astoria, you know, even from Portland, people have more time. People are just willing to sit and have a conversation. And to me, that's the foundation of storytelling, is, you know, you talking and listening and listening and talking and telling your story and drawing the story out in other people, too.
Making that connection.
Yeah. It's so funny sometimes how little we know of one another, even the people we work closest with, you know. And I noticed this. I taught a class years ago at Portland State University in their business program. And there were these are MBA students, and they'd been together for a year and a half. But this was a storytelling class. And all of them came away from the class saying, "I had no idea that you did this and that you did this and that you had these kids and you went there." Just because we just sat and told stories with one another. But, you know, the interesting thing is that has practical value. Because as you know people you're working with, you know them, you start to trust them, to understand them, you develop more empathy, more compassion, you weave kind of the bands of community, in part by sharing stories back and forth, you know. And you learn things. You know, everybody knows, has a different bank of knowledge. And so often in sharing stories, tidbits of information will get passed on. When I worked as a carpenter, we used to take lunch breaks, and we would tell construction disaster stories, you know. And that was great because we always learned what not to do. You know, like, "Oh, I remember, you know, Brad said this." We're not doing that, okay? So story has all
tales
kinds of
knowledge. Warning.
Exactly, warning tales. Yeah, war stories, you know. So.
And in today's environment, it seems like there is I don't know, maybe it's always the case, but it seems like there's a real need for disparate groups to come together.
Yeah.
And I think there's quite a bit of, with storytelling, that can make you see that somebody who you don't see looks or seems like you can be going through very similar things or similar experiences, and can kind of break that down that wall a bit.
That's a really good point. I found that out, you know, working in the prisons or being in Mendocino at these men's gatherings, is just having a little bit of time to share what you're going through, be honest about your journey, you know, where you've been, what's been difficult, what's been good. All of a sudden you respect a person, you understand a little bit about their lives. And a lot of times people that you would never normally have a conversation with, all of a sudden you have something in common. You realize, man, I felt that exact same way. You know, you're from a whole different place, but here we are telling the same dang story, you know, in different ways. But it can be a great way to connect. And I often say that storytelling is interesting because it celebrates the different branches of the human tree. You know, they're all different. When you look up above, you know, the colors and the branching are different, but the root system connects. You know, at the root, we're deeply connected. And that's what stories do. It shows you both the connections that we have and then this incredible varied expressions and personalities we have too.
Wow. So. That's a vivid image, and it sort of seems
think
quite
visually,
fitting.
Right?
Well, let's see. I was going to ask if there was anything else you wanted to add about, like, what keeps you so motivated to, like, share these stories?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, this particular, the body of mythology that I work with, I usually gravitate to it because it actually draws me to it. It's like it magnetizes me to it. Like when I first read the Finn stories, it was like a burr that stuck to me that wouldn't let go. I was like, oh, you're still here. And when I would tell it, it would inspire me. And at times I would just start to, you know, well up and cry. There were certain parts that were just so moving to me. And I just thought that's really one that it inspires me so much. It means so much to me that maybe I could learn it so it would mean something to other people. And that's often what keeps me going, is just to come upon stories or to hear stories from other people that are powerful. They provide healing. They provide humor, you know, information, wisdom. I love teaching storytelling classes because I always learn so much. Everybody has a unique voice, a unique point of view. Everybody's lived unique experiences. And when they tell a story, you really see that. So.
And I'm sure that is very insightful in a class.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I if you have anything else you'd like to add, it kind of looks like this time has gone very quickly. It's been really fun speaking with you.
I can leave you with a really short story.
Oh, I'd love
that's
it.
That's okay. Okay. This is it's a story about a man. He was a rabbi, and he was a brilliant storyteller. And his gift was that he always had the right story for every occasion. It didn't matter if it was a funeral or a bar mitzvah, a wedding, whatever it was, this rabbi always had some beautiful tale to just encapsulate the moment. And somebody once said, "Rabbi, how do you do this? How do you always find the right story for every occasion?" And the rabbi says, "Well, that reminds me of a story." And he said there was a king who wanted to be an archer. You know, he wanted to be a bowman. So he studied with all the masters. And one day he was riding his horse, and he came to the edge of the village, and he pulled up his horse because he saw somebody had shot a host of arrows in the side of a barn, and every arrow penetrated the center of a bullseye. And he'd never seen this kind of shooting, and so he went to a nearby farmhouse inquiring, you know, who the marksman was. And a young farm wife brought before the king a 14-year-old boy, and she said, "This is my son. This is his work." And the king says, "My boy, I've never seen that quality of shooting. What's your secret?" And the boy said, "Well, Your Highness, I have no secret. I just shoot arrows into the barn every day, and on occasion, I go back with little cans of paint, and I make bullseyes around them. And in this way, do I appear as a great marksman?" And the rabbi said, "That's kind of how it is with me. I just take a lot of stories into my heart, into my imagination. I think upon them, I remember them, and life comes along at certain times and makes a little bullseye around them. And in this way, do I appear as a great storyteller before you?" You know, so I always tell people, just like the rabbi, you know, pay attention to the stories that you've lived, write them down, think upon them, and be ready to give them away when the time is right.
I've been talking with storyteller extraordinaire Will Hornyak.
Well, thank you.
Well, thank you.